Hello and welcome to Sonnetcast, William Shakespeare's sonnets recited, revealed and relived. I am Sebastian Michael and this is Sonnet 60. Like as the waves make towards the pebbled shore, so do our minutes hasten to their end, each changing place with that which goes before, in sequent toil all forwards do contend. Nativity, once in the main of light, crawls to maturity, wherewith being crowned, crooked eclipses gainst his glory fight, and time that gave doth now his gift confound. Time doth transfix the flourish set on youth, and delves the parallels in beauty's brow, feeds on the rarities of nature's truth, and nothing stands but for his scythe to mow. And yet to times in hope my verse shall stand, praising thy worth, despite his cruel hand. For his quiet meditation on time in Sonnet 60, William Shakespeare once more borrows, more or less directly from Ovid's Metamorphoses, a text we know he knew well and that influenced him greatly in the translation of his contemporary Arthur Golding. Its calm, philosophical acceptance of mortality notwithstanding, it nevertheless infuses its reflective tone with an underlying anxiety about the drive towards finality that is inherent in our existence and only just about manages to end on a concluding couplet that once more expresses Shakespeare's hope, as it is in this instance rather than, as on previous occasions, unquestionable certainty, that his verse will be able to withstand the destructive force of decay that comes with the passing of time. What, then, does Sonnet 60 actually mean? Like as the waves make towards the pebbled shore, so do our minutes hasten to their end. Much as the waves of the ocean continually race towards the pebbled shore, so the minutes of our lives never cease to rush towards their end, our death. The verb make, to mean move, here implies both an intent and a degree of urgency. We know this from expressions like make haste, or he made for the train, or can we still make the performance at 7:30? Each changing place with that which goes before, in sequent toil all forwards do contend. Each minute follows the one that went before it, and in doing so takes its place, and thus they labour in a continuous sequence that can only ever go forward. The notion that the minutes, much as the waves they have just been compared to, line up in a sequent toil, toil being continuous hard work, brings into the equation an effort beyond that of a natural occurrence, which is underlined by the verb contend, which means to struggle on the one hand, but also to compete. And this latter meaning of competing with each other to get to the end, in the case of minutes, or to the shore, in the case of waves, sooner, if it were possible, before the previous one, is particularly gratifying, because waves do look as if they were trying to take over each other, and anyone who has reached the reasonably to be hoped for estimated midpoint of their life will know how the minutes seem to more and more race each other to the ever larger looming finishing line. Nativity, once in the main of light, crawls to maturity. The newborn human being, once having left the darkness of the womb and entered into the wide open ocean or expanse of light that is life, crawls towards being fully grown and mature. Main really means ocean, but it is clearly used here metaphorically to mean the wide expanse of light. Nativity, as we are still mostly familiar with from the context of Christmas, simply means the occasion of a person's birth, as Oxford Languages has it, and this here stands for the person that has been born in general. Crawl is of course what babies do until they walk, and allowing this slow form of motion to describe our growing into our full adulthood does now invoke a contrasting slow passing of time, which is borne out by our experience. When we are children and very young adults, the world is our oyster and a year lasts us a long time. As a 10-year-old, a year is a tenth of our lifetime and may just feel like that too. As a 30-year-old, that same year now only makes up a 30th, or just over 3% of our lifetime till then. By 50, it is a 50th or 2%. No wonder it can go by virtually unnoticed, and this acceleration only ever gets worse. Wherewith being crowned, crooked eclipses gainst his glory fight, and no sooner have we reached maturity than decline sets in and adversity starts to fight the glorious perfection of being a young person in full possession of our power. Crooked eclipses is interpreted by different editors in slightly different ways. Crooked here meaning malign, most point towards the ominous portents that an eclipse of the sun would have been understood as bearing, and to the darkness that envelops the earth during an eclipse of the sun, or, for that matter, on a moonless night. There is also a more figurative reading, though. Often the moon is partially eclipsed by the earth, giving it a bent or crooked sickle shape, the shape that the upright human body gradually acquires when age forces the spine to curve and our gait becomes bent, thus also fighting against or taking away from the splendour of a strong human form that can take life in their upright stride. Worth bearing in mind here again, as on several previous occasions, is that age advanced quickly on the Elizabethans, and the effects of exposure to the elements, of physical exertion, and of having very limited ways to look after the body visibly and early on took their toll on people. And time that gave doth now his gift confound, and time itself, which early on at the beginning of life offers itself as the greatest gift when it spreads out before us, does now, as we get older, defeat or overthrow or, by extension, take away that gift. Shakespeare is fairly fond of the word confound. As early as Sonnet 5 he says, "For never-resting time leads summer on to hideous winter and confounds him there," where personified time obliterates summer by taking him, summer, to hideous winter. In Sonnet 8 it is the young man who confounds in singleness the parts that he should bear, and following this sonnet here, over the next 9 sonnets alone, Shakespeare will use confound 3 more times. Time doth transfix the flourish set on youth, and delves the parallels in beauty's brow. Time pierces the glorious heyday that comes with youth, and carves lines into the beautiful face of youth. There are exactly 100 instances of the word flourish in Shakespeare's complete works, the vast majority of which in its musical meaning of a fanfare to announce the arrival of an important character or the beginning of a scene in the stage directions. Several times he uses it as the verb we are familiar with, to bloom or to blossom, but rarely as a noun to mean, as it does here, an impressive and successful act or period, as again Oxford Languages puts it. Youth, in Shakespeare's day, even more perhaps than today, when technology and healthcare allow us to flourish right into our 80s or 90s under the right circumstances, is highly prized and directly and strongly associated with a person's achievements and term of agency. Your average Elizabethan of note really had about 10 to 20 years between about the age of 18 and their late 40s to make their mark, if they were lucky. Transfix here means pierce with a sharp implement or weapon, rather than, as we now would mostly understand it, cause maybe someone to become motionless with horror, wonder, or astonishment. And the idea of brow standing in for forehead or face quite generally is also one we have come across before. In Sonnet 2, Shakespeare warns, "When 40 winters shall besiege thy brow and dig deep trenches in thy beauty's field, thy youth's proud livery, so gazed on now, will be a tattered weed of small worth held." In Sonnet 19 he admonishes time, "O carve not with thy hours my love's fair brow, nor draw no lines there with thine antique pen." And in Sonnet 33 he reminisces, "E'en so my sun one early morn did shine, with all triumphant splendour on my brow, but out, alack, he was but 1 hour mine. The region cloud hath masked him from me now." In each case, the brow is, of course, the face. Feeds on the rarities of nature's truth. Time, which in Sonnet 19 was given the epithet devouring after all, consumes the rare and therefore valuable attributes that come with nature's authentic qualities, such as genuine natural beauty. Shakespeare uses truth in different contexts to mean slightly different things, which all, however, can be encompassed in its principal definition, the quality or state of being true. Be that now faithful, honest, sincere, genuine, unadulterated, or indeed factual. He has, as we know from many sonnets that have already appeared, and as we will see confirmed shortly in particularly two sonnets just around the corner, an abject dislike of artifice when it comes to beauty. And so here, nature's truth is almost beyond doubt a reference to natural beauty that requires no artifice. It is the only kind of beauty Shakespeare respects, and it is one that he elsewhere ascribes most particularly and explicitly to his young man. It is also, of course, the beauty that is by definition most susceptible to the destructive force of time. "And nothing stands but for his scythe to mow." And there is nothing in this world that either literally or metaphorically stands up that will not ultimately be mowed down and brought to fall by time itself. The scythe here belongs to time, of course, and we have encountered it before in Sonnet 12, "And nothing gainst time's scythe can make defence, save breed to brave him when he takes thee hence." And yet, "Two times in hope my verse shall stand, praising thy worth despite his cruel hand." And yet, having said all that, my verse shall stand up to time, and so is the hope in times to come shall still be standing to praise your worth, despite the cruel hand of time, which would seek to cut this down too. In other words, my verse once more shall overcome time. And thus far, this certainly holds true, otherwise we would not be discussing this sonnet. Interestingly, this is the only instance in the entire sonnet that either the young man or his worth are mentioned, and so this brief reference to praising thy worth is in fact the only praising of his worth this sonnet does, though it is fair to concede that as part of the large collection, series, or indeed sequence of sonnets we have seen and heard so far, this poet's verse more generally most certainly is doing its job of praising the young man's very great worth, at least as perceived by William Shakespeare. The last time Shakespeare so obviously and directly borrowed from Ovid was in Sonnet 55, where we also recognised a strong resemblance to Horace. As we noted at the time, and again just a moment ago, Shakespeare's whole style is indebted to Arthur Golding, whose translation of Ovid he clearly had access to and used extensively for inspiration. Here is the passage editors commonly refer to in Metamorphoses. It's from Book 15, lines 178 to 186, which in Golding are lines 197 to 207. In all the world there is not that that standeth at a stay. Things ebb and flow, and every shape is made to pass away. The time itself continually is fleeting like a brook, for neither brook nor lightsome time can tarry still. But look, as every wave drives other forth, and that that comes behind both thrusteth and is thrust itself, e'en so the times by kind do fly and follow both at once and evermore renew. For that that was before is left, and straight there doth ensue another that was never erst. Each twinkling of an eye doth change. We see that after day comes night and darks the sky, and after night the lightsome sun succeedeth orderly. The other thing that editors are quick to point out is that this sonnet, with its early mention of minutes and possibly intended, possibly incidental allusion to hour, as in the hours of the day, with the choice of the word hour, as in belonging to us in the same line, sits at position 60, which happens to be the number of minutes there are in an hour, in what may or may not be an actual sequence of sonnets. This question of sequentiality, as I have hinted at a number of times already, now becomes especially relevant, not least because of one particular scholar, MacDonald P. Jackson, who, as I record this episode, is aged 85 and Emeritus Professor of English at the University of Auckland in New Zealand. His work has strongly influenced and very directly guided a new edition of the sonnets by two highly respected Shakespeare specialists in the UK, Paul Edmondson and Sir Stanley Wells, who have rearranged them in what they themselves call a putative chronological order of composition, much in line with the approximate dating provided by Jackson. This throws down something of a gauntlet to traditional scholarship, which has for many centuries accepted the quarto edition as a more or less coherent sequence of sonnets that may well not be completely continuous and chronological, but that broadly makes sense in their division into essentially four parts. The procreation sequence consisting of sonnets 1 to 17, the fair youth sonnets beyond the procreation sequence, which consists of sonnets 18 to 126, bearing in mind that the procreation sequence itself is also part of the fair youth sonnets. Then the Dark Lady sonnets, which encompasses sonnets 127 to 152, and then the two allegorical poems at the end, 153 and 154, which don't really have anything to do with anything else and seem to stand on their own. Edmondson and Wells leave the group consisting of sonnets 1 to 60 intact, but then, following Jackson, start mixing things up by placing sonnets 16 to 77 just before this group, sonnets 78 to 86 just after it, and then sonnets 87 to 103 again before it. Significantly, they also advocate a reading of the sonnets that moves away from thinking of the subjects of these poems as principally one young man and one mysterious woman, and also spread the remaining sonnets out over a longer period than many people have done so far. Most fortunately, though, you do not have to make do with listening to me talk about their approach, because they very graciously have agreed to appear on Sonnetcast, and so our next episode will be our second guest special, in which I will be talking to Paul Edmondson and Sir Stanley Wells themselves about their book, All the Sonnets of Shakespeare, which, as far as we know, for the first time not only orders the sonnets in this particular manner, but also includes sonnets from Shakespeare's plays. So this, I can promise you, is something that's going to be very interesting. It is, as you will know from this podcast, not an approach I unreservedly share, but it is truly fascinating and most certainly worth listening to. Interestingly, as you will hear in this conversation, Edmondson and Wells assume that the order of the quarto edition, which is the traditionally published order and the one we follow here in this podcast, was assembled and therefore numbered by William Shakespeare himself. And this is significant because it implies that he at one point either consciously and deliberately or subconsciously and coincidentally allocated the number 60 to exactly the sonnet that talks about the minutes of our day. And it is not the first time he does something similar. Sonnet 12 very memorably starts with the almost onomatopoeic line, "When I do count the clock that tells the time," which counting, of course, will yield a satisfying 12 hours. For someone like me who is learning the sonnets by heart, these connections between the poems and their numbers, be they intended or not, are especially helpful because they serve as strong mnemonic hooks in the collection, and it is conceivable, but by no means certain, and I'm not even sure whether it is likely that this may have played a part in their ordering. We noted with Sonnet 59 a change in tone from the previous sonnets, and this new, more reflective, philosophical, perhaps also more distanced tonality continues here into Sonnet 60 and, as it happens, beyond. Sonnet 61 will strongly feature the young lover who there once again is absent, thus reminding us of sonnets 27 and 28, and also perhaps of sonnet 43. Sonnet 62 offers a profound and unflinching assessment of Shakespeare's own perception of himself in relation to the young man, before sonnet 63 once again tries to stave off the inevitable, which is that the young man will one day, like Shakespeare, be past his prime and youthful beauty. With sonnets 64 and 65, Shakespeare very much moves within the metaphorical territory here entered with sonnet 60 by meditating on time, and then with sonnet 66 we get a radical new momentum that flips quiet contemplation into frustration and rage. Whether this means by necessity, that therefore the sonnets that follow in the traditional series do in fact follow sonnet 60 and those that went before in their order of composition after all, is not something we can answer here, nor possibly ever conclusively, but it is certainly worth keeping an eye out now for any clues that the words themselves may give us. Certainly, these sonnets 60, 62, 63 and 64 all show us a poet who is at a juncture in life where time matters to him, where his age is causing him to examine his existence, where the beauty and youth of his lover are juxtaposed against his own appearance that is beaten and chopped with tanned antiquity in Sonnet 62, and with time's injurious hand crushed and or worn in Sonnet 63. This would point towards a period in Shakespeare's life that not only allows, but quite actively calls for such self-evaluation, and so it is satisfying to note that even the Jackson dating puts them between around 1594 and 1597, which is exactly when Shakespeare has just turned 30. And that, as anyone who has ever turned 30, or, which would be the approximate equivalent today, 50, is a milestone which makes most men, and most likely many women too, take stock and prompt us to pause and ponder the purpose and trajectory of our lives. This, then, is the mood we find Shakespeare in now, and it is one that is about to produce some quite astonishing and astonishingly beautiful and impactful and powerful poetry of an ilk we have not heard before. Everything you want to know about Sonnetcast is at sonnetcast.com. There's a contact form there. I've said it many times before. There's a donate button there if you want to gift me a Christmas present and help me continue making this podcast. Most certainly, though, and under any circumstances, and particularly now, with the next episode being a second guest special, with two very special guests indeed, I can tell you that Sir Stanley Wells is effectively Shakespeare royalty in this country, and Paul Edmondson and he have worked many, many times together, so they do have a lot to say about Shakespeare and about these sonnets. I do hope you will join me again here on Sonnetcast, where we recite, reveal, and relive the sonnets of William Shakespeare.